Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Virginia Miller, head food and drink writer for the San Francisco Bay Guardian and your moderator for tonight's program. Tonight we're here for Distilled in the Bay Area, How to Drink Like a Locavore. And we're pleased to have an all-star panel with us tonight. It's my privilege to introduce some of the great distillers in the Bay Area and the country. Lance Winters of St. George Spirits in Alameda, Marco Karakashevich of Charbet Winery and Distillery in St. Helena, Davrin Kuchin of Old World Spirits in Belmont, and Salvatore Cimino of 1512 Spirits in Santa Rosa. Please welcome Lance, Davrin, Marco, and Salvatore. All right, so to get things started, I thought we might take a step backwards, and I think we all assume everyone knows what craft distilling means, but I thought I'd ask, what is craft distilling in your own words? Whoever would like to jump in.
Well, I'd say making the best product possible with the best ingredients possible, not trying to take the world over, make everything that you want to make and make it the way you want to make it and you want to drink it, and hopefully someone else is going to buy some of it because you can't drink all of it that you made.
I think at some point, we're independent, right? We're not owned by shareholders. We're not owned by large corporate bodies, so at some point we can make choices and product decisions the way we want. We can truly be artists and do something different and unique, and that's really what craft is about. We can do it on a small scale. We can experiment. We can have batches that turn out better, some that turn out different, and get direct feedback from our customers and try it all over again.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to jump right in here then and say that they're both right. These guys know what they're talking about. And the other side of that is probably putting in even more care than you absolutely need to. You can make a whiskey. You can make a gin. You can make an absinthe. You can make any of those things, and you can make a passable version relatively easily. I'm giving away secrets for all of us here, but it's not hard to be a distiller. It's hard to be a good distiller. It's hard to be a craft distiller. A craft distiller, to me, means that you're putting a lot of yourself, a lot of your passion into it and working harder than you absolutely need to be able to make a product that people don't just pick up a glass and go, oh, that's smooth, that's inoffensive, but they say, wow. Wow is the reaction that a craft distiller is looking for. They want to be able to give you something that you've never had before. And it's like somebody who really, really busts ass when they're making something like a woodworker. You can make a table that's got four legs and a top, and it works as a table, but it's the guy who puts the extra work into the flourishes on the legs and the extra work on the finish to the top. That's a craftsman, and that's what we bring to the picture when it comes to making spirits.
I feel as a craft distiller, we bring our palates to the table, mm-hmm. an expression of flavors and experiences on an everyday level, and designing our spirits around that and more in a broad spectrum of pairing our spirits with foods and thoughts of consumption of them, rather than a craft distiller is a man who goes from grain to bottle, mm-hmm. not has something, he oversees everything from the pitching of the yeast to the separation of the grain to the ambient temperatures of the fermentation rooms, to the temperature of the barrel room, the choice of oak in the wood, much more than a package in a bottle. I think as craft distillers, we all bring our own individual personalities to the table more than a commercial viable product.
Absolutely. And I'd love for each of you to maybe tell the audience what you produce, because there's an amazing range of things that are happening here. So, Sal, what are some of the things? Oh, go ahead, Marco.
Well, no, I'm just getting ready.
Yeah, you've got a long list.
Yeah, I'm getting comfy.
Go ahead, no, please. Yeah, Sal, what do you produce?
Well, my first product of production was a white rye, which I more look at as a rye eau de vie, an expression of the rye, and showing the characters of secondary things around the field that come through in the flavors, wild anise, cross-pollinations. Then I took my rye to the next level, to the barrel, and showed expressions of vanilla, pepper, and the subtlety of oxidation of the distillate in the barrel over a period of time to show more beauty, more essence, and time. And then I moved on. A very dear friend of mine, Jenny Mack, brought me a bottle of ancient 1661 style Poitin from Ireland and inspired me to do my research, to research into the history of what this product is. The original product was made from 95% potatoes and 5% barley to produce a basically potato whiskey to beat taxation at that period, and kind of made it my own as an aperitif to an expression of more than what one thinks of as a potato vodka, to explode with flavors and more of a drinking experience, and moved on into my bourbon styles. Currently I'm working on a cherry smoke bourbon with more of a black cherry stem finish. I've just finished working on a new recipe of a hickory smoked, taking rye malt to the smoker rather than traditional barley, and working more in depth with the enzyme conversions there to tie more of a rich spice, sweet from the smoke of the hickory into the tones of the whiskey to let the pepper from the barrel dance through to, and then due to my heritage, traditional grappa as was done by three generations before me.
There you go.
Excellent. Marco, tell us what you produce.
Yeah. Well, we've been distilling in my family for a while, long time, generations, back in Serbia. So my family traditionally was distilling brandies, fruit brandies from plums, apricots, peaches, pears, grapes, making brandies, making grappas. So we continued to do that as well on a super small scale. And then we started making liqueurs out of fresh-picked black walnuts. And black walnuts are not fun to work with. It's a beast. But it's great. And it's worth it. And then we started making flavored vodkas out of real fruit. I saw a need for real fruit-flavored vodkas back in 96, 97, when there were some two large brands producing a lemon and an orange flavor. So we kind of picked it up and said, we were making a Meyer Lemon Limoncello because that was going to be great. But I'm like, Dad, how many people are drinking limoncello? Nobody's drinking limoncello. Let's make Meyer Lemon flavored vodka. And so we did. And we started making blood orange flavored vodka, started launching flavored vodkas pretty soon. Now we had seven vodkas. And then in 99, Dad and I are sitting around and like, yeah, you know, Jamaicans make great rum, no doubt. I think we can do something better. And we sourced out some fantastic sugar cane from Maui, started distilling clear rum from sugar cane, and then getting fresh Tahitian vanilla beans, and then starting to make fresh Tahitian vanilla bean flavored rum. Still make that, and then we started really focusing on whiskeys. I started brewing beer in high school, and you know, being in the business since you're 10, you know, you start learning what works and what works for you and what works for your family, and more I started figuring out that whiskey is distilled from beer, and you never drink Jack Daniel's beer. Even the Irish, who drink everything, no offense, they're fantastic, they don't drink the beer that goes in a Jameson still. They don't talk about it. So I'm like, you know, if I'm making this delicious beer, let's make some whiskey out of it. And started doing that in 1999. And tonight I've got some that I just bottled from a stout from a Bear Republic brewery, a local brewery. So that's tasting good. And then we distilled tequila because we love tequila, And we don't make any gin. Lance and everyone around here has got a lot of gins coming out right now, so I'm just seeing what's going on in that market and truly amazed with the hand-picked botanicals that everybody's using these days. And I don't know if I'm going to make gin. I don't know. I'm going to save that for my kid.
And you have a few others in there, too, I think.
Yeah. What's that?
I said there's a few more, too. You also make wine, 27-year brandy.
Liqueurs, yeah. Brandies, aperitifs, yeah.
They're a busy family, so.
No real attention span, you know, just love to make it, love to drink it, and, you know, we all get along at the end of the day.
Davern, how about Old World Spirits?
Well, you know, I have a sort of similar story to Marco. His family's from Serbia. I'm from Croatia. You know, a couple countries ago, we used to be kind of in the same crowd.
So. Same.
But it's all good, you know. The reality is, we all kind of started the same way. So my background is, my family has had a winery and distillery for a couple generations, and where I come from, we actually take advantage of child labor. So
that is totally the same.
So as a kid, you know, growing up in a vineyard, you know, end up doing all the dirty work. You know, you carry things around, you wash the barrels, you clean the still, you know, and. But it was always magical when we were distilling because there was this beautiful golden thing. It was warm. It smelled really good. We were making Slivovitz and grappa. And when nobody was watching, I would sneak a little shot of Slivovitz, you know, and then run up and down the winery and the grapes. So that was always fun time. So where I come from, we find fruit. You know, you grow up in the fields, and whatever is fermenting, whatever is in season, it was always a way of preserving things for the different season. So, you know, you don't get abundant fruit year round. So I grew up on Slivovitz, which is the plum brandy.
Yes.
Grappa, a lot of fruit brandies, Calvados style brandy, apple brandies. So we do that as well. So when I came to California in 85, first the weather was amazing. The girls were really cute. And the fruit was just abundant. It was beautiful. It was big and rich and colorful. Smelled good, you know. And it's just a pity not to make some amazing brandies out of that. So we get a lot of fruit from Placerville, from South Lake Tahoe, if you're familiar with the Apple Hill region. So we make a couple eau de vies, a couple brandies. We do make gin. I used to be part of another distillery in Santa Cruz previously. We used to make gin. So gin was actually the first thing that we started making in Old World Spirits. I'm passionate about gin. It's one of those distilled spirits product, clear spirits, that where you can truly be an artist. Because by design, gin is juniper flavor, but everything else is stylistic. So so making a fine gin is an art form. All the other products that we make are made like eau de vie. So we basically, that's sort of my personal bias. I ferment things. I start with a fruit or grain, ferment it, distill it, and eventually, at some point, everything ends up in a barrel. We've always used barrels back home, partially because we didn't have money for fancy stainless steel. So you know, barrels were just there, right? It was easier to chop down the tree and make a barrel out of wood. So as a result, we put blade gin in a barrel and made a rusty blade, barrel-aged gin. You know, some things turn out well in wood, some things don't, but those are sort of the biases that you bring as a, you know, with your personal heritage and a background.
How many gins do you have now?
I have two, officially, two. As I'm claiming.
Mm-hmm. Two in the bottle. Yeah.
Two in the bottle, about 30 on a shelf in the jars of variety.
Yeah.
So the eau de vies, I have a cognac style brandy, which is now on the seventh year of aging. Blade gin, rusty blade barrel aged gin. We have two absinthes. Those of you who are familiar with absinthe, we jumped in partially because I grew up on a Croatian wormwood liqueur called Pelinkovac, and the Pelin in Croatian means the wormwood. So when I was a kid, when I had a tummy ache, you know, my grandma would feed that stuff to me, and that would cure all illnesses.
150 proof.
Yeah, the proof wasn't measured. It was very
long. Yeah,
very effective. So we come from a part of the world where the bitters are prolific, and you cure all illnesses with high doses of alcohol and wormwood. So we have two absinthes, and finally, my family has had corn for a while, so we used to make a corn whiskey from maize. We jumped into rye straight up. You can try it, but same application as Sal mentioned, more like an eau de vie of rye. When I was a kid, my grandma used to have a big wood fire oven, and I would wake up in the morning. She would make a fresh rye bread from our fields. Our neighbors had a cow, so she would bring a fresh homemade butter, and you know, this was my breakfast. This is what I would wake up to. So I wanted to recreate some of that in a rye eau de vie. We get North Dakota rye, American rye, and we try to recreate that.
It's 100% rye?
It's 100% rye.
Wow. That's hard to do.
And yeah, for those of you who tried the making rye, it's just a brat of a grain. It sticks to everything, doesn't mash, doesn't ferment, doesn't flow. So
who cares?
It sticks to everything. So,
and Sal's, yours is 100% as well.
Pure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All my rye whiskeys, my white rye and my aged rye, but I go in a little different direction. I don't stay with 100% malt. I work with a flaked and a malt blend to get a more of a dry, more profound profile across the board. Sometimes I feel malt brings just too much of a strange off balance, as a scotch needs X number of years in the barrel to balance out that astringent base flavor of raw scotch. Where rye, sometimes if you're dealing with 100% malt, it just takes away a little of the subtle nuances that I'm after.
Earthiness, chewiness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nice. Oh, yeah, and one more thing. We also do black walnut chino, which is black walnut liqueur.
You have to.
You have to when you're part of the world. And if I can tell you 10 seconds why that is, because in part of our culture, when the child is born, you plant a tree. You know, people grow up in the same houses that they were born in, their family's grown in. So usually we plant a walnut tree. So as the child grows, the walnut grows. Walnut takes about 13 to 15 years to reach maturity, sort of like coming of age, you know, sort of like adolescence. So, you know, as you're dating, you carve your girlfriend's name in a tree, and then eventually you get married under the same tree. You set up a swing for the kids under that tree. And in
hopefully,
the old...
Hopefully to the same girl.
Hopefully to the...
Yeah. Otherwise it's
a... There's a variety of hearts on the... But in the old age, you sit and play with your grandchildren under the same tree. So it's sort of a circle of life type of a story. So.
And Lance, tell us about what you make at St. George.
Nothing
whatsoever.
No, after these guys, I mean, generations of distillers. I come from generations of drinkers. In our family, when a child is born, we don't plant a tree; we do a paternity test. It's a slightly different sort of a scenario for us.
Still heartwarming.
Some traditions have to start somewhere. This one's starting mostly here. My background, my heritage is coming more from my adopted father, Jörg Rupf, who founded our distillery and who's taught me everything I know about distillation. When I first showed up at St. George 16 years ago, Jörg was making a number of different eau de vies. We continue to make those because, like Sal was talking about, actually like everybody up here was talking about, eau de vie forms a really fantastic philosophical basis for distilling nearly anything. Mm-hmm. The goal in making an eau de vie is to capture the aroma and flavor of an ingredient that has qualities that you really love. So the entire process that we undergo with every product that we make espouses that philosophy. We continue to make pear eau de vie, cherry eau de vie, raspberry eau de vie. We've made eau de vie from quince. I've taken brandies that we've distilled and then reinfused those and made sort of quote-unquote eau de vies from basil and things like that. We have a single malt whiskey, which is what lured me into the distilling world. I wanted to make whiskey. Our single malt uses a variety of roast levels of barley to be able to get really interesting nuances of flavor. We've been playing around with a rye that's 100% rye from Mount Shasta. We're working with a bourbon in-house as well. We launched 3 gins last year. One of them inspired by the amazing botanicals that are available around the Bay Area and built to try and capture the sense of place, and we call it terroir. We do have an absinthe that we released in 2007. We have some liqueurs, a pear and a raspberry liqueur. We do a liqueur from black tea, Lapsang Souchong tea. We do one from a white tea with a number of different citrus fruit distilled into that as well. We do one from coffee, from the abundance of amazing roasters that we have in the Bay Area. And we tend to move around from one roaster to another. Let's see, I'm looking over at the table trying to think of anything else I've forgotten. We do a lot of grappa. We've done grappa for ourselves for a number of years. We also do grappa for other wineries. They'll reach out to us and have us take their pomace and distill that off. Oh, yeah, we've done rum, too. We don't have seven generations of distilling families' money like Marco Moneypants over here does. So we can't go to Hawaii to pick up our sugar cane. We have to go to Brawley. If you've ever been to Brawley, are there any people out in Radioland from Brawley? It's down on the extreme southern part of California, well inland. Great long growing season. We found a few people down there who were growing sugar cane. Really small diameter cane. We brought that up to the distillery, crushed it on these antique sugar cane mills, took that juice, fermented it out, distilled it, ended up with this really grassy agricole style of rum. I love it. I think about 60% of the people who try it hate it. But the 40% that love it really love it. It's the Laphroaig of rums. It's super polarizing. We've done some barrel-aged version of that, which is also lovely, slightly less polarizing. We can't afford to go to Mexico to make tequila, so we ship agave up to the distillery, and we try and beat it up. It tries to beat us up, and at the end of the process, we end with a very small amount of tequila and a huge amount of physical and emotional scarring.
It's not easy.
It is not easy. No. If it was easy, they'd do it here, not in Mexico. Those guys down there work hard to make it.
Oh, my God. It is ridiculously hard to make.
One of the impressive things at St. George as well is that while all this is going on, you also have a little bit of a magical test tube lab, is how I kind of think of it, where you're experimenting with other flavors that also might work. And I've seen all kinds of things back there, from beef jerky to could we talk about crabs? That's been one of my favorite experimental.
Dungeness,
yes, thank you.
Dungeness crabs, yes. Not just,
It's whatever run across the parking lot.
We could talk about those, but I think that's going to send the conversation in a very strange direction. I think we need a little bit more time to move into the strange.
Oh, it's already there, but
after tasting.
But, you know, there are other things that we play around with in there. Recently, I've been making small batches of shochu, which are really, really interesting because of the fact that I distilled white rice. When we try and think of a great way to describe somebody who's really plain, they're as simple as white rice. Man, there's nothing simple about fermenting and distilling white rice, because when it comes through, it's cashew and pistachio and cocoa.
A lot of tropics are coming out when you distill that.
It's crazy. It's so delicious. And it's a great white spirit that has so much more going on than a vodka would. It makes for a really, really interesting distillate. Recently, yams, white sweet potatoes. Yes, we've distilled Dungeness crab and foie gras and beef hearts and a lot of different things. I distilled a Christmas tree one year. Very important to do these things because it teaches us the extreme limits of our art. And they don't always end up being something that's commercially viable, but they're always something that teaches us something and teaches us what sorts of flavors can come through. The crab was one that I did because we had distilled porcini mushrooms and candy cap mushrooms before, and they worked really well. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that because the protein structure of the mushrooms is the same as the protein structure of the crab shells, they're both chitin proteins, that we might be able to get some aromatic components coming through from both of those. We were doing a special event, okay? It wasn't our fault. It wasn't like I just said, hey, let's distill some crabs. We were doing a special event at the distillery that was a series of dinners and lunches put on by a number of the Bay Area's better restaurateurs. I wanted to make something that smelled like the ocean. Crabs ended up smelling more like Fisherman's Wharf on a summer day. A great thought actually come from a friend of mine, Anthony Payone, amazing chef, suggested I distill kombu, seaweed. It's kelp. It's Humboldt County's other weed. And it distills beautifully. It smells like the ocean. You get this whiff of the sea off of it. And it makes a great Bloody Mary. So, job done.
Well, this also leads me into Northern California's place in the craft distilling world today. And as I've been watching, and I'm not a Northern California native, but as I've been watching these guys even the last few years and the incredible stuff that's coming out of here, I'm thinking we might discuss the history of Northern California and its place in the craft distilling world, because I would posit, as we are seeing craft distilling kind of explode and grow around the country, in Northern California, I've been seeing a lot of things happen a lot longer. There's a history. We have some pioneers here back since the 70s, 80s, and you guys are pushing the boundaries, as we're talking about.
In every important arena, Northern California leads the way. Food revolutions, wine, beer, coffee, and now spirits. And California was the very first to actually have a craft distillation movement. The Karakesoviches were on the scene before anybody was even looking. And between Charbet and St. George, 20 years ahead of an actual movement, right. Nobody was talking about craft distillation. It was just a bunch of crazy, stubborn Europeans making great product and trying to convince people to drink it. Germaine Robin. Yeah. What are you guys wrong with that? I'll just sit here.
The two of you got some more years collectively, so.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. This craft distilling explosion across the United States is just it's fantastic. At the same time, it's kind of what was going on during the 80s with the microbreweries that was exploding. Their laws got passed so that they were able to, keep the lights on, sell product, and grow, and be successful. And this is our turn right now, and it's very, very exciting. And hopefully soon, I think we can get all craft distillers. I don't know what you want to call a craft distiller, under 60,000 proof gallons or something like that. I don't know if that's a craft distiller, but pretty soon I think we're all going to start to get together and maybe do like a mini discus, not a full blown discus.
For those of you who don't know, DISCUS is the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States.
Large.
Yeah. It's basically a trade body for the large. If you're not part of what most people are not familiar with is that really the spirits world today is really dominated by a couple of oligopolies. There's just a couple of large companies. You know, our big friends at Diageo, have $12 billion to $14 billion in revenue, $60 billion market cap. I mean, that's not a craft anything, right? And there's a couple of those guys around that basically dominate the markets, including the distribution channel. And the laws, those of you who are not familiar, go back to the prohibition. So we still have a three-tier system, which limits us what we can do, how we can do it, how we get our labels approved, how we get our formulas approved, what you can sell, what you can't sell, how you classify the spirit. So the licensing, it took us 18 months just to get entitled to be legitimate to produce. So all these things limit us, and number of states, each state has slightly different set of laws, which make it really difficult for us. So there's a sort of movement across the country, and then here in California, obviously, we've been so progressive with all the other areas that we're trying to get together and influence some of the legislature to make it easier, to make it simpler, more accessible for people to get out to the market.
But one of the things I think that helps make California the place that's sort of the hotbed for this is that the community out there, all the consumers that are here, tend to be a little bit more adventurous. They've seen advances in those other categories, in food, in coffee, in wine. Yeah. And so when we put a product out into the market, we find a very, very enthusiastic audience for it. And you can't find a better atmosphere to be able to be a small distiller in, because we need to be able to reach out to people. We don't have – one of the big things that some of the large companies have that we don't have is the ability to go out and buy advertising and sell a lifestyle around our product. What we do bring to the picture, the thing that we can put in there is our passion and a unique product experience. So you don't have to relate to an Absolute ad somewhere and say, oh, my gosh, that's really speaking to me. You try a product and you say, I really like that way that tastes. It's a really unique perspective for it. And because as we all know, Californians have much better taste than anyone else. is this only going out to a California audience?
I think so. No.
Only marginally better than all the rest of the states, but it's still an appreciable margin. But it's that audience that we have available to us that really, really makes the difference, and I think it's one of the things that really fired up this industry here. And having wine and beer kick it off was a great start. And you guys were ready for something a little stronger after that.
And I think that's one thing that really changed the wine and beer industries is some of the lightening up of some of the laws, if you will, years back. And we haven't seen that happen yet with spirits the way it needs to kind of let it explode as it needs to. But that being said, I think California and Northern California in particular has done amazingly well and really been advancing, advancing the cause, if you will. And one of the interesting things I'm noticing as questions come forward, and thank you so much. There's a lot of questions already, so you're sparking interest all over the place. We haven't even started pouring. Is that I've noticed a couple people are asking questions along the lines of interest themselves in getting started. How would they start at home, or what were your challenges in getting started? You know, some of you might have been distilling with Dad when you were 10, but, you know, with Lance and with Sal, too, how did you kind of decide to jump in to distilling? Sal, you want to tell us about that?
I started jumping in. It was more the fascination of fermentation and the birth of the ethanol from the sugar. And following that, and then with a wine background, I have 40 harvests under my belt as of today. Just being in the cellars and watching the grandfathers taking the pomace from the press to the still, weighing it out, water breaking it to make the grappas, was what intrigued me. And it was more, as a child, we're raised with drinking wine from the time we're old enough to sit at the table. So it was an expression of taste and pairing throughout my life. And I like to distill, and my fascination with distilling is more, I distill to eat, to pair what I make with the vision of what I'm making. Where would I drink that? My rye whiskey is my porterhouse steak. My poutine is my oysters on the half. My grappa is after dinner. My bourbons are before dinner. I've introduced a wheat whiskey recently, which is my summer evening. It's light. It's aromatic. I call it effeminate whiskey. It's very soft, rounded, where my rye is more complex, more deep, more rich. And that's more of an expression of a winter evening in front of a fireplace, not a summer evening watching the sunset, mm-hmm. wanting to have a glass of whiskey and just enjoy the evening.
Can we have a dinner break now?
Yeah, I'm hungry.
You're making me hungry, Sal.
Where's the foie gras?
Yes.
I feel like 2 days
so,
left.
So, Lance, how did you get into distilling?
The generous work release program from prison. I had been a brewer, and my desire was probably much more ego driven than Sal's. Beer is really lovely. It's great, as Marco will attest. And it's fun to make, but it's got a finite lifespan, and I wanted to be able to make something that could outlive me. And a whiskey can do that. And so I got a small still. I put it in my garage. I started bringing beer home from the brewery, and I started running it through there. It started making really, really great whiskeys. I had no idea why they were great. So at one point, I took a bottle of my whiskey to St. George Spirits, presented it to York, and talked for a while, and eventually weaseled my way into a job at the distillery. So that's how I started. And he said, we'll try you out for a month. I went back to the brew pub the next day, quit my job, said, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to spend the 18 months getting myself licensed and find some backers who can get me rolling on a distillery. So fortunately, I didn't have to go through all that.
Yeah, it's not easy getting licensed in any state. California, it takes a long time. You need to have
both state license, fed license, and you have a premise already.
Permits,
and more permits, and a couple more permits too. It's a long process for you to want to start out, but definitely doable. Go for it. If you've got some time, start it up.
There's no better time than right now as far as just the awareness of the category. So who is asking these questions? Who wants to start a distillery?
The states, actually, they know. They've heard these questions before and stuff. So actually, they even know more about it now than back in the day. Back in the day, they're like, well, DS what? I don't know what that is. Type 14, 12, I don't know, what are you looking for? But more and more, they're they are starting to get more comfortable with the permits that they issue. So, yeah, I agree. It is getting a lot easier.
So the reason why we talk about these permits and licensing is because, if you didn't know, even owning an unregistered still is a felony. So let alone making it, let alone selling it. So,
do you know the statute of limitations on
that? I don't know what it is, but
just make sure that
we couldn't confirm or deny this.
If you can disconnect the still from the coil, then it's just an artifact. It's all good.
It's artwork, It's
this answers
shiny.
The home hobby question. It's a felony hobby, basically. So.
Yeah. Like all the best hobbies.
Like all the best hobbies.
We're not advocating anything.
Yeah.
But also tying into what you were saying, well, all of this about laws and the rest, we have a savvy audience as well. They mentioned the H.R. 777 bill before the U.S. House of Representatives right now to reduce taxes on craft distillers. And what can consumers do to support this? That's a very nice question, whoever that came from.
We do have letters of support in the back.
Thank you.
Bring your pens.
Maybe someone could explain a little bit about the law, or briefly.
That one was a while ago, wasn't it? H.R. 77?
Is it still, is it already gone?
I don't know if it's active still or not. No. What's that?
In general, both beer and wine industries have a small producer set of laws, which basically make it easier, cheaper, right, to for the small producers to survive because they have lower tax rates. If you're not familiar, we actually have excise tax. Sort of, we're taxed with tobacco, with firearms. The special tax that's levied. So it's the same for large producers and small producers. For us, beer and wine have a sort of a small beer producer. So they pay significantly less. As a result, enables the small producer to, compete with the larger guys because you don't get the economy.
17 cents a gallon, for wine.
Yeah, and if you look at a typical 12-pack case of spirits, 12 bottles, 750 milliliters each at 40% alcohol, the federal tax on that is about $25. So we're generating lots and lots of revenue for all of the programs that you guys take advantage of. So and we're happy to do that, but we'd also like to be able to take some of that and redirect it to more research and development and making more products.
So U.S. government, just for information, collects over $5 billion a year in excise taxes from distilled spirits. So just to give you a scope.
It starts to add up after a couple of years.
It does.
It does.
Well, and completely switching gears here, I'm also seeing another theme in a couple of these questions is intrigue on the level of taste. Essentially, if I summarize these, I'm kind of getting from them that they're asking, can I have tastes as impeccable as you four? How do I train myself to have this palate? And how do you decide what your tastes are going to be, where your next direction is going to?
Well, it's definitely a contact sport. you need to train every single day, every single night. You need to train. It's all about the training. And pretty soon, I was lucky. I got to work in different tasting rooms when I was a kid. And, I tasted four different Chardonnays, two different Pinots, and five different Cabs every single day from this one winery. And, man, you really start to taste the nuances of every single vineyard that this stuff is coming from. And pretty soon it's like, I don't like Pinot from this region, or I really like Pinot from that region, and I like Cab from this region or Cab from that region. And it's stuck. So, it's all about the training program. And, if what I look for is flavor and balance of flavor, term heady, If you ever had a bad tequila that's kind of really sharp, it kind of makes your eyes crinkle up a little bit. You're like, oh my God. This is great. Yeah, this is amazing. Chances are the distiller just let the heads run through because that's the highest alcohol, and they wanted to keep the booze in the bottle. So they just said, okay, that's fine. We're going to keep this and let it run. They didn't cut it out. And that made an extremely unbalanced spirit between heads and tails. And then what I like to do is balance the heads and tails so that it all tastes great and has a nice, smooth, long finish. That's just my art, my artistic style of producing spirits. But as far as how to train your palate, training every day.
I think one thing is that we all make certain decisions as distillers, and sort of like a chef or an artist. You know, if you look at Picasso's paintings, even if you don't know if it's Picasso, you'll recognize it's a Picasso. If you listen to Rolling Stones songs, you're going to recognize the artist. So we sort of do the same thing. You make a certain set of decisions that resonate with you. You know, whether it's your process, how you distill the ingredients. So a lot of our spirits will have a certain thumbprint. You know, we leave our mark on the collection of what we do. So so our palates and our nose is going to be different. You know, all of us have a different chemistry of the mouth. Depends what kind of mood you're in, what time of the day it is, what time of the year it is, what you've eaten. How much Marcus had to drink before, but you know it's so the tastes are very subjective, right? And we as distillers will make certain decisions to make our products that will be reflective of our taste, our preferences. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and building on that a little bit, everybody's born with different sensitivities as far as their sense of smell and their sense of taste. probably the most important place to have more of an objective sense of smell and sense of taste is to know where flaws are so that you can identify them and figure out where they're coming from, whether it's in the fermentation process, which is likely the culprit, or in the distillation. After that, being able to go with that complete subjectivity, that subjectivity of your taste and your sense of smell driving what the flavor and aroma profile of these spirits is going to be, that's what makes it yours. That's what makes it unique. It's that thumbprint that Davern's talking about. It's being able to make a product that speaks about who you are. And that's what's really important. If you don't have something to say, if you don't have something that you want to do that's different, you shouldn't get into the business. If you have something that's new and unique to say, then do it and do it your way. And hopefully you'll find people that like it, but you don't have to go through a focus group to figure out what's good. You figure out what's good for you. And if you stick to that and you're passionate with it, then other people will come around to that. It's a big enough world. There are lots of people out there. You don't want to make it the same as something else that's out there. Otherwise, you're going to have to base it all on advertising. If you make it different, then you're going to be able to find a different crowd of people to drink it.
And we don't make enough for everybody, so.
I do.
We hope to.
So one thing I learned in kindergarten, make enough for everybody.
We all want to grow up and be like Lance.
We should all have higher aspirations.
Sal, do you have any thoughts on that question about developing taste and how you kind of come to find your unique style?
For the drinker or for what I'm... For the drinker, I think your taste is developed in your preference of food, your spice that you like, everything from a summer evening, a smell that drifted through the window, crisp morning air. Those are things we tie to spirits because they're high flavor profiles and they hit the brain in different areas in your sensation of what you're drinking. A spirit tells a tale. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's a journey that you take upon when you put it to your lips. So to train yourself is you're looking for that journey. We spend our whole lives searching for that special someone, as we do in our spirit. So it's an individual's preference to search that out and find that experience is how I would say train your palate.
Absolutely. And
can I give just one practical advice for those of you who are training your palates? It's not about a taste, right? It's not about a taste because your tongue can differentiate how many flavors?
Six. Seven?
Well, technically four. We have receptors for sweet, sour, you know, bitter, and salty, right? And there's a fifth one, umami. But it's really your nose, right?
With
there's
a sixth now,
sixth
too.
Sixth sense. It's the ESP.
I'm going to go with seven.
You're going to stick with seven?
Yeah.
Seven. You got to be able to name them all.
Backwards. Wait, but it's about your nose. So
umami and sorbet.
Fail. You know
what's in your cup? You had it.
Anyway, the conversation's falling off quickly. But, you know, do blind tasting at home. You know, I do this with my kids. You know, I have two teenage daughters that can basically tell the difference between, you know, Pear Eau de Vie and rye whiskey, you know. And it's all about just blind tasting. Just train your nose, right? Put it in a similar glasses, get stuff on the table, and just bring your friends over and just go crazy. It's fun, too.
So we're talking about individual taste, but kind of taking this back to Northern California and the Bay Area, do you think there's a California style? We've kind of touched on this a little bit, the adventurous palate we have in this area, but do you think there's a California style that is developing or has been already established, really, in the spirits world?
Yeah, I think it's bold, it's flavorful, it's complex, it's got a lot of body, it's got a smooth finish. And you're going to be able to really taste hand-picked pine buds. Pine needle bud?
Doug fir buds.
Doug fir buds from Mount Tam. I mean, you're going to be able to pick those out. And, it's kind of like the beer, you know, like California beers, like Racer 5 or, what's that big, huge brewery that you
Sierra
guys are
Nevada
using? Sierra Nevada. I mean, it's like that really started a revolution.
Yeah.
First thing to
know. I know, it's gone already. It's a lot of complex, intense flavor. This isn't Canadian whiskey that we're making, you know, with like 45-year-old barrels that don't do anything but just vaporize the stuff out. You know, it's like this. You're going to get some barrel, but it's not going to be too much barrel. It's going to be a nice balance of the barrel. Sometimes you might want to use a used barrel, but you're still going to get used flavors from the barrel. And, you know, it's going to have a lot of flavor. And that's what Northern California is all about. It's intense. It's real. It's balanced. And for me, it's got a long flavor, a long finish.
And I agree. And I just want to add one more thing. Fresh.
Mm-hmm. Fresh.
You know, when I was designing Blade, it was all about what can I find locally. It's fresh citrus, fresh cilantro, fresh ginger. You know, like fresh live things that you can experience locally. So that's what it's about. Whatever you could find around you.
And Davern, just for those who don't know briefly, Blade Gin, just that California profile, can you explain that real quickly?
Yeah, so I got the inspiration for Blade. I was hanging out in Santa Cruz. Actually, there was this one moment when it was a little surfing competition, those of you who have spent some time in Santa Cruz. So I was hanging out with a bunch of surfers. You know, they were talking their little lingo, you know, and shredding, cutting, you know, hanging 10, whatever. And Blade is actually I know, I'm not one of them. But Blade is actually a slang term for a surfboard. So at the time, there was a smell of fresh citrus in the air. There were some oranges and lemons blossoming. We were actually having some Asian food with some local cilantro, fresh cilantro and ginger. And, you know, that's what it was inspiration. It was the smell of the ocean, from Santa Cruz. And it just all kind of blended to me. I said, this has got to be a gin. You know, and that's what Blade became. But it's what Marco said. It's about being big, about being bold, fresh, sort of in your face, kind of like the rest of us here.
But clean and precise, you know.
Clean and precise and balanced.
Not sloppy, but really well made.
Well behaved.
Yeah. I don't know about that, but.
Sal or Lance, any comments on California style?
Yeah, I'm not really sure about a global California style. I think that I think what both Davern and Marco said hits it pretty well. But it's again about being able to explore a little bit more outside of stylistic boxes that the industry tries to put itself into. One of the things that's a California influence is the desire to do things more locavore. Right now, the bourbon that we're working on, the rye comes from Mount Shasta, the barley comes from Chico, from our good friends at that little brewery up in Chico. And if you guys ever venture over the hill, some of you might be from over the hill or through the tunnel, there's a little restaurant in Oakland called Olivetto. And Bob Klein, who runs Olivetto, smuggled in some amazing red flint corn from Italy, planted it up in Woodland, and he's growing it now for a thing he calls community grains. And that's all well and good to make polenta from that, but I'm thinking organic, yeah, non-GMO corn, that's this heirloom varietal. We put those three things together, we've got an all-California bourbon. And that, to me, is part of the California style. Taking a tradition outside of its traditional zone and sort of reimagining it. Taking all those ingredients and looking at them from a new perspective. Like, they're ingredients that could go together to make something greater than it's ever been before. And that's the goal for us with something like that.
So shifting one other direction here, I like this question because I write about a lot of cocktails as well as spirits, but there is a question about cocktails. And as we know, there is such a crossover between the spirits world and the bar world. And a lot of times it's your great bartender using your spirits in a cocktail that kind of gets a lot of people turned on to it. And this can happen. So the question was, what are some of the most unusual and exotic interpretations essentially you've seen, or, you know, maybe it wasn't even unusual exotic, but I'm thinking anything that kind of clicked with one of your spirits that really got people turned onto it through a cocktail. What was the cocktail?
Man.
Where do we begin with that one?
Yeah, there's
a number
so
of
many.
Them. Yeah.
We're inundated with amazing bartenders, mixologists, whatever you want to call them, whatever they want to be called. Sometimes they rankle at one instead of the other. There's so many. And what's great is, I was talking with Lou earlier about this. I used to be such a purist about the way our stuff would be served up. Just got to drink it neat in the glass. You do anything else, I'm going to come and beat you. And I'm not a violent person. Ask anybody. And as the talent level in the bartending pool has increased, so many of these guys can take these things that we make and elevate them in such a way, utilizing fresh ingredients that we couldn't put into the bottle. We can't put lime juice into the bottle and have it stay alive. It's gonna die down and it's gonna get ugly after a while. They take these other fresh ingredients, mix them in with our products, and make something greater than the sum of its parts. And they're too numerous to name, but there have been a few that have just really, really surprised me. Especially our terroir gin is one that I love to have neat, don't want to have anything with it. I've had people take that and serve it to me in a way where it's like, wow, I can't believe I made something that went into this. It's so much better than what we were tasting before. So,
I personally don't make our spirits for cocktail purposes. I mean, really, if you look at one of my taglines, and maybe controversial, but I mean, it's good stuff needs no special effects. In fact, I feel so strongly about it that, you know, we trademarked it. Because I believe that good stuff should be good straight up. You know, a nice car doesn't need spinners and spoilers. Good steak doesn't need a lot of barbecue sauce, right? Good stuff should be good in its pure individual form, and you shouldn't need to cover it with a bunch of things to swallow it, which is really where the original cocktails came about, right? But at the same time, I believe that the good spirits should be a great building block for terrific cocktails. And I'm kind of from a, you know, ex-communist country where people don't have a lot of money, they just drink simple things. And, you know, I really believe in what Mondavi used to say, drink what you like what you drink. Mm-hmm. If you like a cocktail with just a, you know, gin and tonic, or it doesn't have to be fancy, it doesn't have to be, you know, whatever you find fresh in your backyard, or, you know, whatever is simple. Of course, we have a prolific community of cocktail mixologists and people who just do amazing things with our spirits, But the idea is to make a great spirit on its own and let you guys get creative at home and make some amazing things from there. And send us pictures,
yeah,
and recipes.
We all know the cocktail culture is exploding right now. And so with that, I'm stoked if some of the world's best mixologists want to use my products in their cocktails. That is sweet. Dale DeGroff, one of the most iconic
of all bartenders in the United States. 10 years ago, I took my ruby red grapefruit vodka, mixed it with some maraschino cherry liqueur and something else, I didn't even know what he did. He did it so fast and cranked it out. I'm like, Jesus, this is amazing. I would never be able to do that. I never thought of even thinking about doing that. And here Dale's just like, here, yeah. Try that, Marco. Oh, my God.
That read really well for the radio.
That was really good. Yeah. Another one, I use our Charbet Blood Orange Vodka, and I use Lance's coffee liqueur. And chocolate and oranges, really work well together. And then you put a shot of espresso in there, and you do four of those, and you're up all night. You're a little dehydrated the next day, but you're just a live wire. I mean, it is just amazing what happens. It's a lot of fun mixing cocktails. I had my Asian friend, James Lee, who has a taco bar in Boulder. Figure that one out. Fantastic everything there. He mixed the green tea vodka that we make with some Pimm's and some lemons and some limes and some oranges and some mint leaves and a splash of Sprite and made the J. Lee green tea cup. It was a modified Pimm's cup. Jeez. Pitchers. That's the way you want to drink this stuff. I mean, it is amazing. There are so many different cocktails. I mean, right here at this table, I mean, there are hundreds of different cocktail combinations that we could do with our own products, just blending them all together.
If you think about it, there was 1920s and 30s was sort of the heyday of the cocktails, right? And there was a lot of traditional cocktails that sort of fell off and were forgotten. So I think that next generation of spirits that we're producing today, artisanal spirits, our gins, our vodkas, our brandies, whiskeys, are just better made. So if those cocktails were great before, they can be really amazing now. So just the revival of the tradition, the Negronis, Manhattans, Old Fashions, you know.
Spirit-driven cocktails.
Spirit-driven cocktails, yeah.
I mean, you do Manhattans. I mean, before, you had to add a lot of sugar and a lot of flavor to really hide the flavor of the oak that was in this super totally oaked whiskey. Now with the whiskeys that are, you know, more delicate, they have a lot more flavor, more chewy flavors and earthy flavors. You don't have to add all the bitters. You don't have to add all the sugar. And what happens is all of a sudden that Manhattan turns into a floral, spicy Manhattan. You're like, oh, my God, this is really good. This is amazing. This is not like what I used to have. You know, it is.
So unfortunately, we are running out of time. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time, and I'm glad we were able to get to some of your questions because we're going to have a shortened time for questions here. But I would say we probably have time for maybe two or three people to come to the front if you would like and ask a question one at a time, just if you could be real direct and bring your question to us. That would be great.
Please stop pushing.
One at a time.
Security.
In the meantime, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're here today for Distilled in the Bay Area, How to Drink Like a Locavore with Lance Winters of St. George Spirits, Marco Karakashevich of Charbet Winery and Distillery, Davron Kuchin of Old World Spirits, and Salvatore Cimino of 1512 Spirits. I'm Virginia Miller, head food and drink writer for the San Francisco Bay Guardian. All right, and your question.
Hi, I'm a teacher, and I always struggle with getting my students to like the purity of what I'm teaching them and also selling to them, keeping them interested, because too often these days people need to be entertained, need to be pleased, need to be convinced to buy. So how do you personally balance the artist in you with the business person in you?
Very good question.
So you're going out every night, and you're hitting your accounts. You're taking care of your friends. You're showing what's going on, what's new, and how to make cocktails with it or not, and show what is new coming off the distillery. It's a constant push. If you're not there, Lance is going to be there. Sal's going to be right over there. I mean, you got to stay on it. And because we don't have huge sales forces, you're looking at my sales force. I got to do it, and it's just a constant pressure.
I think the other side is to balance the entertainment and the artistry together is just being honest when you're talking with people yeah. about what it is that you're doing. And hopefully it resonates with them. If it doesn't resonate with them, then you need to move on and find different students.
You're wasting your time.
Because there's bound to be somebody who's into that. But if they're not into that, they're the ones who are going to be responding to the mass market, mass media advertising instead. They're the ones that want to see a product being drunk on Jersey Shore before they actually buy it themselves.
Gentlemen, this is vodka.
Yeah, exactly. Oh and, yeah. Instead, what we want to be able to talk to the people that want to hear from us, and that's what becomes our market and our audience.
I think at the end of the day, all of us here produce things, right? We're not just marketers. So at some point, you can be just yourself. You can be authentic, and I think the passion and commitment comes across. I think people eventually get it, you know. It's not like we're bottling somebody else's stuff and we're trying to spin this random story. So I think authenticity...
Sometimes. Yeah, if well, you got know, time, yeah, run the line.
You know, at some point, just being authentic, being passionate about it, you know, comes across. So because you'll never outspend the big guys. We never will. We cannot... We'd have a lot of fun.
Yeah. I wouldn't spend all the same things.
I could spend $2 million a month.
So in some ways, we are teachers, right? We're educating, sort of like you're educating your students. You know, we're educating the masses. I think one of my personal objectives through this journey is to really educate, you know, what spirits are all about, how they're made, and what makes a good spirit. And I think the more people know, the more they can ask the right questions, the more they can make better decisions. And ultimately, you know, you have one body, right? You know, might as well put good things in it, so...
Yes, the next question.
Yes, you all excuse me. You all mentioned that one can train one's taste, nose, and so on, and train and train and train. But it would seem that some people have more natural gifts to discern the differences between the subtleties. You mentioned subtleties of this fruit or that banana and so on. And when I taste things, I'm either like it or don't like it, but I find it very difficult to discern subtle differences, and I'm wondering what are the natural gifts that one might have and other people don't have, or does it make any difference?
Well, yeah. Alcohol tolerance is one of them, but when I was a kid, my dad had the set of different essential oils. He had like 25, 30 different essential oils, and he's like, smell this, what's this? Smell this, what's this? Try this. It's just the time, you know. It's the time of getting it connected to your brain. That, you know, this is eucalyptus. I mean, this is camphor. This is cardamom. This is cinnamon. This is nutmeg. You know, juniper. Everything. It's a training.
Winemakers have them. I mean, if you've ever seen winemakers, there's kits. You can get, you know, a couple dozen different taste profile, and literally you go through it, you know, smell it,
smelling,
and then you do blind tasting, and so you start associating mentally what it is with the smells. But they're basically kits of these little vials, as Mark was talking about.
They're standards, and the key there is learning to identify those so that you have a set of terminology to be able to identify different flavor and aroma profiles from. And that's the key. It's building a lexicon, and it's really, you can build it for yourself. You don't need to... Having a name for it makes it easier to remember what it is you're smelling and tasting, but you don't have to have that. There have been times at the distillery where we're comparing seven different batches of Pear Eau de Vie, and after a while, you can't just say, well, this one smells more peary than the other one. And sometimes we'd start describing one as shinier than the other, or one as flabbier than the other.
As long
as the lexicon that you're using is either good enough for you to be familiar with, or it's one that someone else is understanding what you're talking about and you're working with them, that's all you really need. I mean, not everybody's as well endowed as we are with great senses of smell and taste, but you know, it's something that you can absolutely learn if you just give yourself. That was for you. Just give yourself a little bit of time with some of those standards. And sometimes it's as simple as going out and buying five different gins and sitting down with each of those, totally. Because those are all made with things that you'll recognize. Not everything in there, but you'll recognize almond, you'll recognize cinnamon, juniper. You'll recognize the juniper, you'll recognize caraway. All those things are in there. Some of them use rose petals. Some of them use cucumber. If you sit down and compare them, sometimes it's easier through that act of comparison to figure out what it is you're smelling than just smelling one thing and trying to dissect it. So that's, I think, a really good tool for you to be able to use as well.
And unfortunately, we are out of time for questions.
Oh, one more. He stole us there.
Come on. Just one more.
We have, what, 30 seconds left? Oh, he's standing
up. See, it really fast. Okay.
Yeah. When you hear descriptions both in wine and spirits of a hint of vanilla or a note of that, do you actually put that stuff in the distillery, or is it just an effect from the distilling?
Great question. No. No, it's those things, like you can smell a red wine and get a hint of red pepper. They don't put red pepper in there. It's a fermentation co-product. Mm-hmm. Fermentation generates alcohol and CO2. Oftentimes, through the metabolic pathways of the yeast, they generate a lot of other flavors. That's our stock in trade, is generating all those flavors. You don't want a whiskey that just smells like malted barley. You don't want one that smells just like corn. Right. You want all those other things. They come from that. They come from the barrel aging process. You'll get vanilla and cinnamon from the wood. You'll get all kinds of different things like
what
that.
What yeast you use makes different flavors, too. I mean, you can use a brewer's yeast. You can use a Belgian yeast that gives off like clove and banana flavors. That one yeast won't even come close to tasting.
And I'm sorry, we have to wrap up our time
here. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much. Our thanks to Lance Winters, Marco Karakashevich, Davrin Kuchin, and Salvatore Cimino for their remarks here tonight. And we thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Virginia Miller, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. All right.